I'm Joel Vaughn. We're in our series, New Life for Men and Women Too. And today's topic is learning to play again, with the idea that maybe we once knew how to do that and that perhaps we will learn again. I haven't told any jokes yet. And I thought that this would be a good session to use one of my expert jokes. You know, every time somebody gets up in the front of a group and they have to talk and present ideas and tell people what everything is all about, especially psychologists and psychiatrists, we think of them as experts. And so I've collected a number of expert jokes, and I often start off my talks by telling one of these to kind of debunk the notion that I am the expert. And this particular story, maybe some of you have heard it, it's been around a little bit now, I think. I still enjoy telling it. It's about the Harvard University professor who is traveling the country lecturing on his award-winning research. And he is really pretty tired of the whole business. He's been to every college and university across the country. And he's just tired, and he has a chauffeur who's driving him, and while they're going to this lecture at one of the big universities, University of Chicago, he says to the chauffeur, you know, I can't take it anymore. I just can't do this talk one more time. He says, I want to propose something. How about if you do the talk tonight? He said, you know it just as well as I do. You've got it memorized. Give the slides, you know, give the blurbs, and we'll switch, he said. I'll take your chauffeur's livery, and you take my pipe and my jacket, and you give the talk. The chauffeur says, why not? He was tired of hearing the talk, too. And so he got up there and gave the talk, and to a standing ovation. I mean, this was prize-winning research, and the chauffeur did a beautiful job. But as luck would have it, right at the end of the talk, as the audience settled down, there was a question from the front of the room, and one of the professors stood up and said, doctor, he said, this research is very interesting, but there is one question I have on your fourth slide. He said, you had the exponential factor to the fifth power, and my research indicates it should be the tenth power. Now, how do you account for that major discrepancy? So the chauffeur looked at him. He said, that's a dumb question. He said, that is really a dumb question. He said, you know, that's the dumbest question I have ever heard. He said, I'm going to show you how dumb that question is. My chauffeur is in the back of the room. I'm going to have him stand up and answer. Now, I don't have a chauffeur in the back of the room, so I'll have to answer whatever questions you raise today, but I did want to kind of have this to be a little bit more lighthearted session, and so excused from taking notes or getting too serious. And I want to begin the session today by reading something that on the bottom of my blurb says it was written by Nadine Stair from Kentucky, Reflections on Life at 85. But I was curious to read in Alan Loy McGinnis's new book on confidence that he has this same blurb and says it's from some unknown Trappist monk. So this is obviously one of those things that kind of circulates around and nobody knows who really wrote this, but it really speaks to leisure, use of leisure time, learning how to play again and really leading a life that has some fun in it. So, it's entitled, If I Had My Life to Live Over. I'd dare to make more mistakes next time. I'd relax. I would limber up. I would be sillier than I've been this trip. I would take fewer things seriously. I would take more chances. I would take more trips. I would climb more mountains and swim more rivers. I would eat more ice cream and fewer beans. You have to get this to the higher ups here. I don't know why I'm so preoccupied with food in these. I would perhaps have more actual troubles, but I would have fewer imaginary ones. You see, I'm one of those people who live sensibly and sanely, hour after hour, day after day. Oh, I've had my moments, and if I had it to do over again, I'd have more of them. In fact, I'd try to have nothing else, just moments, one after another, instead of living so many years ahead each day. I've been one of those persons...
Honey, you get back. You go back in.
This lighthearted session was going to be... Where was I? Let's see. I've been one of those persons who never goes anywhere without a thermometer, a hot water bottle, a raincoat, and a parachute. If I had it to do again, I would travel lighter than I have. If I had my life to live over, I would start barefoot earlier in the spring and stay that way later in the fall. I would go to more dances. I would ride more merry-go-rounds. I would pick more daisies. So, that, I think, sets the tone for what we want to talk about today, and that is how can people, and as we, you know, wrote this book, New Life for Men, I forgot the plug, New Life for Men, a book I wrote with Ron Klug a couple of years ago. When we wrote the book, we were, of course, addressing men primarily and the problem that they have in this business of play. I don't know if you were at the initial session, but I talked about some of the dichotomies that men struggle with and that we wrote the book around. And the one that is particularly relevant to today's presentation is the dichotomy of performance versus play. And we have a whole list of these, about 12, that kind of point out what we call the beaten path for men, the road that most men are going down these days, and a less traveled road, a little bit like the road to Copper Basin that we went up today. But performance is kind of where it's at for men. You know, performance is the issue. How do you gain success? How do you function in an independent and successful way? How do you be number one and come in first and win? As opposed to play, which indicates an ability to not always be first, to have some fun along the way, to enjoy the moment. As we, Ken and Karen and I were hiking up to Copper Basin today, we had a great time. We talked a little bit about somebody who, a friend of ours, who we haven't seen for some time, but whose idea has always been that you have to be able to say that you've been someplace, you know, and always is going to places to see things, to eat in a particular restaurant, or to say, in a sense, she's been there. And that's a little bit what kind of performs around, but never experiences the play. It's like when she gets there, okay, where do we go next? You know, okay, I saw it now. I saw Copper Basin. Time to go. Let's go to the next hike. You know, or now that I've seen the Grand Canyon, now I go to the next national monument. And so many times we get caught up in this business of kind of collecting things, experiences, situations, and it really turns out to make vacation time and leisure time a time of just kind of running helter-skelter to each next significant scene and capturing it on film and then moving on instead of really experiencing what it's like. And I think that's one of the good things about Holden Village, at least coming as a guest, that is that you come and you're kind of stuck here. You know, it takes so long to get here and it's so hard to get here that once you're here, you do have to stay a while to kind of get involved in what's happening in the village. And that becomes a way then that you can not just collect the experience, but actually involve yourself in experience and have some fun with the experience. Okay, so the issue is really play and how men can do that, how they can learn to do that. Before we talk about that, I guess we need to talk about what kinds of problems men and women get into when they use leisure time or when they try to use leisure time. We talk about a couple of these in the book. One of the main problems that we see for men in terms of the use of play is the fact that play can sometimes deteriorate either into wasted time or into performance time. So leisure time can be wasted time, or leisure time can just kind of get turned around into performance time. And there's a kind of a fine line here, because what it might be wasted time, I suppose, to one person would not be wasted time to another. But we think about sometimes the destructive ways in which men play. One of the destructive ways in which men play is by drinking heavily and regularly. Many men use alcohol to relax, to kind of have a good time, to go along with parties or events. But many men have problems with alcohol or drug use in a way that creates wasted and even destructive leisure time. We talk in the book about weekend alcoholics. There are a lot of men who go to work every day and never miss a day's work who essentially crash on weekends or on vacations or even evenings in a way that is very destructive to effective use of leisure time and to family and to self. Another way in which a lot of men these days kind of get caught in an excessive use of destructive leisure time is TV watching. It's not just men, but I talk with a lot of women about their husbands, of course. They talk with me about them and in an office setting. And one of the things that several times women have come about is, I can't get my husband to do anything with me. All he does is watch television. And he watches television in the evenings. He watches television the minute he comes home from work. He sits down, he turns on the television. We watch television during dinner. He falls asleep in front of the television. Mm-hmm. He gets up and he goes into bed. He wakes up the next morning and he goes to work and he comes home, and the same thing happens then. And then, of course, on Saturday and Sunday, he also watches television, often sports events and football games. And as all of you know, now there's even a 24-hour sports channel that you can get on ESPN, and you can watch every possible sport that you can imagine anytime you want. In some ways, I can identify with this problem, not because I'm an excessive television watcher. I don't think I am, anyways. Pat's here somewhere. So I don't know if I am. Although I'm a sports fan, and I do get into watching baseball games, especially with the Cubs. But I guess I began to look at what I did when I watched television, and I think I understand what happens to some men and women when they watch television. That is, it becomes a kind of way to space. You know, I can sit in front of a TV and watch a ball game and watch the game, but just kind of feel suspended in a way. Not terribly involved in the game, but also on hold, in a sense, mentally. And I think that happens to many men, and I think in some ways it's an escape at times from tension and stress and pressure. Sometimes it's an avoidance of family and marriage and relationships and intimacy. But it does create problems for many men and for families. I know what you're thinking. Well, how do you get out of that problem? How do you help that kind of problem? And I don't know that I have an effective way to do that. What I've done in the office is try to get, certainly if the man is involved and would come in, we try to talk about what it is that's wrong for him in his life, what isn't working well. And almost always, if you can get that person to talk about their life, and if they have some sense of trust in talking to you about it, they will talk about something that they are escaping from, that they are avoiding, either personally familially or often vocationally, often work-wise. Many men are very unhappy with their work, and as a result, it becomes very difficult for them to enjoy play, surprisingly enough. The second general area, though, that creates problems for men that I wanted to just kind of throw out to you is how some men turn leisure time or play into performance. These are people that sometimes are called compulsive fitness buffs. These are men and women who seem to find it very difficult to really do anything without becoming totally immersed in it, to the point that they turn it into work, in a sense. And while there is some release, of course, for a person who, think of runners often in this way, it can be very addictive. Exercise can be very addictive in lots of ways. There are indications that that high levels of exercise and exertion over a period of time release certain chemicals in the brain that actually dull pain and heighten a sensation of well-being. And these can be, there's some indication this can be addictive to people. And certainly there is goodness in it, in the sense that a man who is that heavily involved in an exercise program, or a woman who is into aerobics 5 times a week, while there's goodness in it, in that the body is being improved, in a sense, and the person's probably healthier, they're probably eating better, looking better, feeling better about themselves. When it becomes a kind of obsession that is difficult to break, then of course it can get in the way of lots of other things. And believe it or not, I've had women who also have come in and said that they have lost their husbands to their exercise program, that all the man does is go out and run, that he runs, he gets up at 5 in the morning and runs and comes, goes to work and comes home, runs in the evening, runs in marathons and in 10Ks and triathlons now on weekends. And this too can break down an effective relationship between husband and wife. I call these people type A at play, because I think they have basically the same kind of pattern. They work very hard, they're hard-driving individuals, they're compulsive individuals often, they're dedicated, driven individuals, but it makes it very difficult then for them to come down from that activity pattern. And they simply move from being very dedicated and driven in their profession to being very dedicated and driven in their exercise. And this then can be a complicating factor. There was an interesting article, by the way, in the New England Journal of Medicine about, well, I guess it's probably 4 or 5 years ago now, that compared the personality styles of long-distance and heavy-duty runners to anorexics. And they found a very similar personality profile, that it seems to be a kind of compulsive exercise that when you try to get the person to stop, they really can't. They don't want to. When they don't run, they're extremely irritable. They get depressed. They don't function well. And they only feel good when they've done their running for the day, much like an anorexic who is desperate about not eating, only feels right when they have not put any food or a minimal amount of food into their body. And anorexics, by the way, are often also compulsive exercisers, people who spend a great deal of time worrying about, thinking about food. Maybe that's what's going on with me. I've been thinking about food all the same. I mean, I'm developing something here. But worrying about food, thinking about food, not eating food, often cooking food for other people, but then when they do eat something, feeling they have to exercise to get themselves away from whatever food they have taken into their body. So I just wanted to raise those couple of issues before we turn to something else here. So there are lots of ways in which physical exercise, play, use of leisure time can be destructive. But what are some ways in which we can use it in a more effective way? What are some suggestions and ideas for lower stress living, learning to play again? Well, we turn to page 80 of New Life for Men, and by golly, there they are. Let me just review a couple of them with you because I think they contain the gem of some ideas for how we can learn to play a little bit more effectively. The first one says, make time your ally, not your master. Invest in a daily planning guide and create a realistic schedule for work and reserve prime time for family, leisure, and special projects. The basic point here is that one of the things that we often have to do in our busy lives is we have to schedule leisure time for ourselves. We have to set aside time during the week, during the month, certainly around vacation, or many times it will slip away from us. This is especially true, again, for people who are successful, who work hard, who spend an awful lot of time volunteering, doing things, always filling their time. You will fill your time with work and with activity, and you will often find it difficult to say no to the requests of others unless you also block out time for opportunities to play. A very important concept. Two says, seek out a few gentle people who affirm you as a person. One of the things that you need to look at in terms of the use of your leisure time and your play is are you spending time with people who are also interested in play? Again, one of the things that happens is that we tend to gravitate to people who are like us. And people who are hardworking and people who are compulsive and orderly and heavy duty in terms of keeping busy often find other people like that. And when you're in that kind of situation, it makes it hard sometimes to relax and let go. I have a friend who's also a psychologist. We were in a PhD program together. I worked with him for about 3 years. No, not 3 years, 2 years. Maybe not even 2 years. I couldn't work with him after a while. He was so hyper and so type A, so aggressive about his work, that whenever I was around him, I would feel myself in tremendous tension and competition with him. I wanted to show him up. He turned on something in me that just kind of charged me to do more, even when I wanted to do less. And so when he would take on extra work, I would find myself thinking about extra consulting jobs that I could take on. And he continually talked about his work. I mean, he was truly a workaholic. And I found myself really charged both negatively and positively by him. I found it very uncomfortable. I never told him that, but I did stop working with him because it really had an effect on me. And I found that I had to be around other kinds of people so that I didn't get my type A in play and in gear. I have a tendency to toward work addiction also. I was talking with Pat about this particular session, saying, well, how about if you come up and we just kind of dialogue about how we use our leisure time? And she said, well, it's going to be pretty negative. I said, what do you mean it's going to be negative? I said, well, we can talk about how to come to Holden Village. She said, well, do you call this leisure time? You know, and she's right. I tend to do these kinds of things. We tend to schedule our vacations around, you know, well, we could come here and this would be a great opportunity. And 1 hour a week or 1 hour a day, that's not a bad teaching schedule. But you forget about the preparation time. You forget about the time that you have to think about this. You forget about the anxiety that's created when you have to come in front of a group of people who are your peers or your superiors in many ways, and you have to be ready to do that. And so it becomes like work. So, you know, maybe just to kind of, again, she's told me this before, but I have to hear it a number of times usually before it kind of really sinks in. But again, it gave me some insight into how Maybe I need to rethink, too, the use of leisure time. Now, I shouldn't be too hard on myself because we've had some other good time. We spent 4 or 5 days in Seattle before we came and just kind of bummed around. And we had some time early in the year that was good time. So we really have to be careful about how, for some of us especially, and many men have to be careful about how they use that kind of time. Here's, I think, something that's very important. Seek out interesting and rewarding experiences. Try doing things that are new to you. Sample foods you have never eaten. Go places you have never been. I think one of the things that is very helpful for us in the use of leisure time and play and having it and doing something that's different than our work such is truly to do something different. And so the opportunities are all around us, but we tend to be creatures of habit. If I go into a snack bar, I order a cheeseburger. That's just the way I do it. You know, I've had 8 million cheeseburgers in my life. I'll probably have 8 million more, and I never, you know. And when we went to Seattle, for example, they had squid. I've never had squid, and I should eat it. I mean, I should try it. I want to try it, but you know, then that cheeseburger picture popped up in my mind, and or that familiar seafood that I've always had, and yet those can be experiences that are really little minute play experiences. We were in San Diego a couple of years ago, and I had shark for the first time. I mean, it tastes pretty much like swordfish. But I got a lot of mileage out of eating shark that day, you know? Just talking about it and thinking about it. And so, you know, there are lots of opportunities like that that we probably don't take enough advantage of. But I want to get to a point here where I stop talking a little bit and let you have a chance to share some things about your use of leisure time and how you would change things if you could. But before I do that, I want to set that up by reading a little poem here that I find that I really liked, and so we included it in the chapter on play. It's by Hugh Prather. Maybe some of you are familiar with his work. He's written Notes to Myself, and he does a couple of others that I can't think of at this point. But this is an interesting one. It's called If I Had Only. He writes, if I had only forgotten future greatness and looked at the green things and the buildings and reached out to those around me and smelled the air and ignored the forms and the self-styled obligations and heard the rain on the roof and put my arms around my wife and it's not too late. I think that's an important concept. It's not too late. As you think about that poem, and as you think about Nadine Stair's reflections on life at 85, if you had your life to live over again, if you could do something in the way of leisure time differently, if you could, what's ahead for you? What are you looking to? How have you found ways to really relax and kind of beat the cycle of wasted time and compulsive. Well, I think that's an individual decision and an individual judgment. I think what most people are looking for is some sense of rejuvenation, some sense of refreshment, some sense of variety in their experience of play and leisure time. But I think that becomes kind of an individual situation for each person. It's a little hard to tell somebody, here, go do this and play. If I told you to go out and fish, I mean, you're shaking your head already. If you told me to go out and fish, I'd say, you know, where's my pole? I would love it. So I think it's a little bit hard to know how to plan that for somebody else, or how to know what somebody else needs in that. Is that kind of what you were getting at, or? Yeah, I think it's something that you would experience a subjective sense of enjoyment with. One of the things, for example, again, that we would talk with men about is trying to get past the notion that you have to be an expert at something, you have to do something well to enjoy it. Many people will not do something because they're afraid of failure. I talked before about the fact that in talking with men, we found that one of their biggest fears was fear of failure. And so a lot of times what we do is we hang back from something because we think, I won't be able to do that, and I don't want to look foolish doing it. My own experience is we were at Lake Chelan before coming up here, staying overnight, saw a guy out, was it surf sailing, or what do you call it?
Windsurfing.
And I thought, well, I'd like to do that. I'd like to learn how to do that. But then I thought, no, I'm not going to get out there, and that thing will crash, and I'll get out in the middle of the lake, and I won't be able to get it back. You know. And so we say those things to ourselves, I think, internally, and so we restrict a tremendous amount of opportunity. That's part of the reason why we don't want to try anything new. We're afraid we won't like it, or we're afraid we won't do well with it. And in fact, the process of trying it is really the enjoyment and the relaxation. One loses oneself in doing it. Not the accomplishment, but we always focus on the accomplishment. That's why we get into competitions and winning, and instead of just jogging, you start running marathons. You get all the shirts, you know, and little trophies, and you know, all this. You know, I even wrote in the book that I was a runner. Well, I used to be a runner until my knees kind of began to hurt me. But there's a certain kind of pride about that. I run 3 miles a day. Well, that's good, but it shouldn't be the end all and be all, and that's what we make it. We make the end result, the relaxation and the leisure, rather than the experience. In a way, I think that if the activity or if the leisure time act or activity or experience has anything to do with, if you can measure it in any way, then it's probably not effective leisure time. I mean, if you keep it in terms of miles or times or how many roses you've grown in the last 3 years or those kind of things, I think you're in danger of losing the sense of experience. Or how the biggest fish you ever caught, or how many muskies you caught in the last 5 years or whatever. I think the more it goes into that direction, the more it loses the experience of really down one letter in the alphabet. Well, again, for, you know, the type A personality is the person who is focused on performance, and again, my experience is that many of those men don't stop until something happens to them. That's the business of getting blown out of the water, and when the heart attack comes, or when the divorce comes, or when the business fails, or whatever, that's sometimes when individuals will be confronted with that kind of behavior and may be able to change it. But we'd be trying to get men thinking more about that kind of behavior and thinking about how they might consciously change it.
So the awareness of it.
The awareness of it. The,
voluntarily back.
Yeah. Anybody else found a way to, yeah?
That's type D.
The person who might just kind of be so low-key that that there wouldn't be a lot of energy or there wouldn't be a lot of interest in doing something.
No particular ambition or goals, just kind of going through the motions.
Mm-hmm. And unhappy with it?
Unsatisfied.
See, because there is another aspect of this, I think, for both things like type A and type B, and that is that everybody can't be the same. We're all unique in a sense in the way that we are. What we do try to talk about, though, is are you happy with it? In other words, and is it working for you? If a type A person, a real active, dedicated, hardworking, 14-hour-a-day person is living it and loving it, and it works for him and for his family and the other people around him, then who am I or anybody else to say, you're doing the wrong thing? You know, you just ought to relax more. The same would be true for this kind of individual, a type B person, a person who's just kind of low-key, who kind of moves at his own pace, who does things his way, maybe doesn't do too much. I don't know that if that person is unhappy with that, or is happy with that and the people around them are happy, that that's so bad. But on the other hand, when the person is not working well or living well with that kind of lifestyle, then I think the question is raised of what can we do. So I guess I just wanted to put in that disclaimer that it's not, you know, I'm not here to, or as a psychologist, I wouldn't be interested in just telling everybody how they ought to be from my perspective. That's not appropriate either. But rather, are you unhappy with that? If you're unhappy with that, then, you know, how can you, probably for that kind of person, you'd have to work more toward the scheduling side. How can you set yourself up in certain things that you have to do? For the type A person, you try to get them unscheduled. You know, you try to back them off from all those plans and responsibilities and obligations. For a person who would be more type B, you would be saying, what have you built into your week? How can you learn something new? What can you do that that schedules time for you to be with other people, to get on a team, to play in a tennis league if that's what you want, to play a musical instrument? We talk about trying to get men out of the observation and into the activity. That leisure time, that is time that's just kind of watching other people, is usually not particularly good, because it usually revolves into watching the sporting event, going to the baseball game, watching it on television, reading about it in the newspaper. That's a hobby, and that's use of leisure time, but it usually isn't as good as playing baseball, coaching baseball, being involved in the actual activity. So I guess the primary impetus I would see for the type B kind of individual would be, okay, what can we get going here for you? What can we get set up and scheduled?
Schedule with your friends, it really helps too, because then you come home tired and think, oh gee, I don't have a way to go. You've already told this person, I'll meet you there, I'll be there.
Yes.
And so then you just go.
No.
But that really helps.
Very good point. People who have low motivation, if you get somebody else hooked in with you, Karen, you were talking about this in our hike today, you know, she gets a number of people kind of scheduled to walk with her, and if one doesn't come, the other one comes, and she feels obligated to go. That's the kind of thing that that can work, to have a partner who's beeping the horn, and you don't feel like going, but you get your sweats on anyway, and you go, and then you find that you really enjoyed it, and you're glad that you went. Yeah. I think that's true. I don't know, I think there are good and bad effects of that. There's no question that children are shaped differently today by television. Television is a fantastically influential medium. And kids have, I think, become less active because of it. I think they've also grown in lots of ways because of it too. And so it's very difficult, I think, to just put it all in the negative category. And I don't have a good awareness of the research that's been done to address that particular issue, for example. And I think it's true. I think that you'd probably find that kids use maybe less imagination or a different kind of imagination than they did before. On the other hand, you could argue, you know, the other side, that what has happened with all the toys and the television and all the rest that we have, that kids actually have more tools and more images with which to imagine. But I think what has happened, that we have become more sedate as a society, and I think that's probably where we're moving, that we are less active, although there's been an upsurge recently in terms of the exercise boom and the focus on physical fitness. It's not clear whether that's going to be, you know, fad or fact fully here over the next number of years, but I think probably we have become much more, and children have become much more observer than actor in our world in some ways. But, you know, again, imagine the imagery that they're presented with. My memories too are of sitting around the radio, you know, and imagining what the shadow looked like, and you know, the Green Hornet and all of those things. The Lone Ranger. Yeah, and it was like when it came on television, it was like I saw that, you know, it's just that I wasn't on a screen before that. But I think you could argue both sides, that the images would be more limited because they're more concrete now and you see them, but at the same time, they also might be more evocative. No question, you know, as a conscientious parent, we would want to be careful about how much time and all the rest, but you'd still have to admit if they're not watching at your house, they're watching it down the street, and they're showing them things on television at school, and the whole business of VCRs. You know, the impact of VCRs is confirmed. People watching movies. It's incredible. We didn't have a VCR for the longest time, and then one day my daughter came home from junior high school, and she said, "Dad," she said, "are you a doctor?" And I said, "Well," I said, "what do you mean?" She said, "Well, are you a doctor?" I said, "Well, I have a PhD, that's a doctorate of psychology." I said, "Well, why do you ask?" She said, "Well, the kids at school don't believe you're a doctor." I said, "Well, why don't they believe I'm a doctor?" She says, "Because we don't have a VCR." The assumption was that anybody who was a doctor had money, and anybody who had money was going to have a VCR. And, but you know, it's those kinds of electronic marvels that are dictating a lot of what we see and do, and it's all around us. But no question, I think we should limit it, but it's hard to limit it in the midst of this kind of environment and this kind of society, this kind of technology.
I've done it, and it is boring.
Yeah. It's boring and it's addicting, isn't it?
It's
very.
In fact, there's some that wouldn't come to lunch because
that's right.
But when my kids say they don't have TV, the universal thing that said to them is, oh, how can you stand it?
Yeah.
And the universal thing that said to us as adults is, well, I don't really watch it very often.
We have some friends also who, for the longest time, with three kids in their home, did not have a television. And two of the children handled it beautifully. Bright kids, worked independently, read. The parents both were teachers. Two of the children, I think, would have liked it at some time. When they'd come over to our house, they'd watch it. But really handled it quite well. The third absolutely could not manage it. And that child would do anything to watch TV. Would sneak to other kids' houses, would go around, would when she'd come to our house, and just would, you could not get her away from the television. They had a terrible time with her. She'd fight with them and argue with them, when are we going to get a TV? This is a bad thing. Everybody has a TV. And so I admire the fact that you don't have a TV, and we turn our TV off during the Monday through Thursday. We don't watch TV Monday through Thursday typically, for the school kinds of stuff. And we get flack about that, but it's a difficult thing to do. Again, when you are in a lonely battle, you know, in a society that is focused
on. One person's work and another person's leisure. I come home from work and I allow myself an hour to sit down and watch television. And I'm not going to feel guilty for sitting down and watching television. And I don't think maybe somebody else that is not their form of relaxing.
Right.
My form of relaxing. And I used to feel guilty because I should be up cleaning the house or doing this or doing that. But so I think there's nothing wrong with what I'm telling you.
No, I don't think there is either. I don't think there's anything wrong for kids or for parents. But I think it's like a lot of things in life. You know, if you go to the extreme with it, it can be very harmful. But yeah, that's a very valid point.
But say Channel 9, you can really see something like that, which you wouldn't see.
Public television, you mean? Yeah. And sure.
Yeah.
There are very good things on TV and some
and you can
real.
Learn a lot, and a lot of nature.
Yes. Yes. Some of it's beautiful. A lot of it's mindless. But some of it's beautiful. And, you know, maybe we need some mindless stuff sometimes too, I guess.
I want to get
back to this issue of play and type A personality for a minute. We talked about scheduling leisure activity, but if you're scheduling your whole, if you're pigeonholing your entire day and you've got a real active profession, when it comes time to schedule that playtime, we often find that what happens is just a collapse.
Yeah.
And that there isn't the energy or the drive or, you know, there's too much spent in profession to invest in playtime. And so as a couple, we're learning how not to play.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of, you know, as we get more involved in profession, creeping away from playtime. What can we do about the situation?
You mean you're learning to not play, but
right.
Liking it?
Well, when we schedule playtime, it's, you know, well, between 5 and 6 or 15, we don't have anything to do.
Let's get over the,
you know,
oh, I
that
see.
Kind of thing.
I see. But, well, yeah, I think the goal there would be to reduce some of the other activities, because if you're so tired that you can't relax except by taking a nap and then you don't have any play, you probably need to really look at what you do with your schedules. And I think this is occupational hazard for families with two careers and kids. In our society, in the typical kind of family and neighborhood experience, everybody's going three directions at once and everyone has to be driven here and there and all these different places. And it's overwhelming at times, and the only thing you can do is take a look at it and see what can we cut back on.
It cuts out the spontaneity that I think is so critical to play.
Mm-hmm. I think another thought in that way would be if you're in a position to take vacation time a couple of times during the year, or at least even one major vacation. One of the things that I do, or I try to do, by the way, is that even though I'm very busy during the year, and we're all very busy in our house, Pat working, the kids going, our one daughter now, our oldest daughter is living independently on her own, and my working, is that I do try to take a month to 6 weeks off just in the summer from my practice. And so I work hard at trying to just get a bunch of time set aside and then do some different things with it. I often don't know what I'm going to do with it. And sometimes I just stay around the house for a week. Mm-hmm. And for example, before we came here, I was trimming the bushes in the front of our house, and it was about 85. I was loving it. I just wished I had more bushes to trim. Now that was that was back then. Now that was a good use of leisure time. It was play for me because I hadn't had an opportunity to do much around the house, and I think for busy people, if you can get some blocks of time and just go with the flow or plan a vacation that isn't making, you know, one stop every night at each point and all the rest of that. See, but it is what we do. But that's this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do in our families, too, in our society. It's pervasive at a lot of different levels, and I believe it's this. It's get our kids into as many things as we can because all those other kids are in them. And if you're not driving them to piano and Cub Scouts and dancing and all the rest, it's like we're building skills in them too. And it's not, you know, don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but we've got to be careful about this because it's easy to get hooked into that scheduled, rigid running here and there and competing with Mrs. Jones, who's got her kids in everything.
But on the other hand, I think that you need to develop hobbies and interests when you're young, because you don't later. I'll always remember the neighbor we had who retired. He was an accountant, and his wife substitute taught. And the day she came home, and she was furious because he had spent the day cleaning out her underwear drawers, and her he had nothing better to do than rearrange her drawers. And he didn't fish, he didn't golf, he didn't do anything, and how sad, because he had, you know, another 20 years maybe that he had nothing to do.
Struck me that he was rearranging her drawers. Yeah.
I didn't mean that as a pun.
Yeah. One more question. I was gonna dismiss the class early today because this is a discussion on play, but obviously we're not gonna be able to do that. So.
Oh, I have one little point here. I think I don't think was brought up, but I've been accused of being a workaholic, and short-term relaxation for me is washing the car, like you doing the bushes. That can be relaxing, especially if you're in no hurry, you don't have a time limit to do it. But long term, I gotta leave for the weekend or a week or something to get uptight. And the thing that I want to point out, when a workaholic says he wants to do something and it is a leisure thing, the wife should detect this, and vice versa. I want to go to an air show in the motorhome, and the wife can think of 100 excuses why we don't have time to do that. But if I say it, that means I need it. Otherwise, I know how to work. So I don't have to say, hey, we have to do this, do that. I know that.
Uh-huh.
So the wives have to detect sometimes what their husbands say, because that's the leisure time that they really need. And vice versa. If you got to listen to your wife sometimes. You don't have to do something. Don't think of 100 things to do, which is work, because someday you can just kind of maybe explode, then you've got problems.
Mm-hmm. Any last comments? Well, let's really have some leisure time for the rest of the day, and also enjoy these big juicy hamburgers. Tomorrow we're going to talk about finding our way to God. See you then.